I've never been part of a forum. This is a forum. And the idea is around a subject to use the expertise that's available in our midst to deal with the subject. And the subject that we want to deal with, the issue, is pain. And John Schramm did a beautiful kind of introduction of how in America, as our culture, we strive mightily to evade pain more than any other kind of culture. And I suppose that makes sense. But we want to deal with pain. Is it a curse from God? Is it a blessing from God whereby he refines and strengthens us? Our pain is our pharmacist's fortune, and it's the doctor's challenge. You know, what is, where does it fit? What's happening? How do we respond to it? And some thoughts about pain. The four people that are here along with me have some things to say, but very important in a forum is the opportunity for you to ask questions and throw in your two bits. And while nobody has two bits, everybody's at least 50 cents worth or something like that. It's informal, that's what I'm trying to say. Not structured, rather informal. To my right are the Wolds, Erling and Marge, with specific experiences out of pain. They'll speak a little bit about that to introduce things. To my left, the Collins, Marge and John. Midge, I'm sorry. I got Midge down there. We all make mistakes. I'm sorry. MD, physician, family, kind of practice. I think that speaks for the expertise. Why not start with Erling, or that's the way we planned, to share some of his experience and thoughts.
Almost 7 years ago, I was body surfing during vacation at Laguna Beach in Southern California. I've always loved the ocean. It seems to be that salt water flows through my veins since I'm a Scandinavian, and that was the ultimate dream of vacationing. I went a mile with my wife up and down the beach, decided to launch in, and swam out, rolled back on one giant wave, went out for the second. No one told us that there was a storm brewing in Mexico, caused likely by a small earthquake. When I saw that second avalanche of water come, I knew I had only split second to make a decision. Some Scandinavian minds don't work that rapidly. And when I made a decision either to go with it or into it, before my decision was made it for me. It slapped the side of my body, upended me, smashed me against the ocean floor. And when I came to, I was floating with my head, hands, and feet under the surface of the water. And I recognized that I was completely paralyzed, that I was one swallow away from death. The byproduct of this, through long tale of woe and triumph, is the fact that I live daily with pain. It's quite excruciating. It floods my whole person. I can't feel it in my neck uniquely. That's where somebody spoke to me. But my arms and fingers and my feet and my torso somewhat constricted because of it. So that pain becomes an everyday experience. And of late, even worse, maybe something with the spinal cord. Because third, fourth, and fifth neck vertebrae broken isn't a very easy thing for the body normally to recover from. So that this is a vital topic for me, and we're going to share some of our experiences tonight.
I guess I need to react to Erling's comments, and probably that's the normal thing, because if someone we love or even another member of the whole human race or the Christian family suffers, the scriptures say we all suffer. We're interconnected, we heard tonight. And certainly in a relationship like ours, there was no way that I could be there on the beach and help pull my husband's body out of the water, totally paralyzed, top of his head bleeding, and all of his upper teeth knocked off by the force of the blow on his head and his jaw hitting the upper teeth. And to see him turning blue and to know that he was close to death, to assist in giving him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, and then to ride in the ambulance 6 miles through Laguna Beach, crowded with tourists, to South Coast Hospital, where they drilled into his head, put the tongs in, put traction on him, and the doctor told me he had a 2% chance of living, and less than that of ever walking again. And so the kind of pain that I experienced was not physical pain, but the emotional pain that all of us suffer when someone we love is hurt or suffering. And so we've lived with that, as Erling says, for 7 years. And it's almost like having a third person in your house all the time. Because if I were to ask you, as Rich Kemmerer said tonight, how do you paint people? How do you paint pain? What shape does it have? What brush strokes would you use? What colors would you use to paint pain? And so pain has a physical shape in our house, and we have to relate to each other through and with that daily pain. That's enough for me to say, I think, at this point.
It's a different kind of experience on the other side, and you know, I guess in sympathy, that's an extremely difficult kind of an act to follow, and maybe for most of us in terms of experience and the kind of thing that we may share, but a little different perspective, Mitch, and some comments about the whole area.
Yes, a definitely different perspective. I suppose I'm concerned a lot more from a social angle, from the way our society has oriented itself toward not necessarily pain, but a lot of the things that are going to produce pain for us, more and different kinds of pain because of the way we have chosen to live. A lot of this pain production is directly related to the fact that we have decided we want to do away with our physical discomforts in general. And we have turned to industry and technology to do away with certain things that we have defined as pain and physical discomfort. And in the process of doing this, we are creating new and different kinds of pain for ourselves by our lifestyles, by producing effects of our technology and our industry, new diseases and new shapes to pain that historically people haven't had to deal with. My concern is mainly not just the pain, but the way that we're continually choosing to deal with the pain. It almost seems as though we have made some kind of an unconscious pact with the they out there, the industrial complex, to ease discomfort for us and to invent miraculous things to take care of the pain that they are also by producing for us. And so we talked this morning about marvelous machinery and of technology like the CAT scanner, which is a miracle machine. And yet, I think we have to decide what we're giving in return for these miracle machines that maintain us the way our technology and our orientation toward technology want to maintain us.
What was that word, the CAT scanner?
Mm-hmm. It's just, I just threw that in as
yeah,
an example. We can get into that more later. I won't get specific about that, but.
Could you be specific, you know, like tell us a simple story of what it is you're trying to say in terms of our wanting to be away from pain or in that process creating new pains for ourselves? Is there a simple illustration of that?
I think we've had, there are lots of illustrations, and I'd like to get into to the specifics, but to list the kinds of pain and be specific about it would take too long for the purposes of the forum, and I'm hoping that everyone will come to the seminar on Wednesday so that we can get specific about it. But I can mention two things that I think you're all familiar with that are maybe the most recent and most dramatic. One is 3 Mile Island, and the other one is Love Canal. Those are two new syndromes in the history, the medical history of Western cosmopolitan civilization. And there are many others that aren't as dramatic and that are not as obvious to us in our daily lives.
Okay, John, from a physician's standpoint, some things about pain?
Of course, that's my stock and trade. And from a physician and a scientist, I'm interested in all kinds of pain, defining the pain and determining the quality of it, and in most of all, in trying to relieve it. And as in our first example tonight, there are some people who it's not a matter of diagnosing it and relieving it, but in helping them to learn to live with it for the remainder of their life. And that's, there's a lot of research going on in this particular area. We do know that there are thresholds of pain, and that we all have a different threshold. One of the biggest areas that this is probably being seen in now is in the field of obstetrics, where many more and more women with proper training are able to go through the delivery process with the use of little to no chemical support to relieve their pain during the process. This can be done by training them ways of relaxation or of concentration on other functions of their body so that they do not dwell then upon the more painful aspects of the delivery process. And I think it's a very healthy aspect of obstetrics nowadays, and it's relieving us of the burden of what the possible chemical effects may be on that the fetus or the newborn child after their delivery. This is being expanded now into other areas, into other chronic pain areas, people with arthritis or those with serious injuries. And there has been a development of pain clinics or specialties that deal with nothing but pain and who are helping people to learn to live their life with constant pain. And I'm sure that you probably have been through that process and have gotten some help from that.
All right, before throwing everything open to you for your questions and observations, any kind of interaction here between the four of you, on the things that have been said, or you want to add to this point? It's...
I think better to let them speak.
All right.
Ask questions.
A multitude of possibilities now in connection with pain.
Chuck, I just wonder if you as a pastor don't also bring a little bit of expertise about pain. I just wonder if you could share your perspective on your dealing committee with some people, both physical and emotionally painful situations. What are your bits of expertise that you bring to that?
Somebody else ask a question while I think about it. Erling, you may want to throw something in at that point too. No, he's in the same boat.
Well, pain is a normal function of life. It's just like death. One shouldn't expect to escape it. I suppose there are three different kinds of pain. Some that we invite because we do wrong, or someone else does wrong and we're part of the process. Kid told me the other day, riding with his best friend, sitting looking at the driver, all of a sudden he turned his head and he saw a wall 30 feet ahead, and they were going at a pretty fast clip. Well, he just broke his jaw and a few other little bones in his face. But the other fellow, you know, did him a disservice. It happened to be because he was a human, part of the whole experience of living. Some of our tragedies are caused by just the fact that we are part of our society. We are part of the illness, part of the disease, and all those potentials. But the third, I suppose, is the fact that some of them are just tragedies that for which there is no definition. Even Jesus talks again and again. Well, St. Paul, for example, said that he reveled in the book of Philippians, that he reveled in the fact that he could fulfill the sufferings of the body of Christ, and talking about the resurrection, said that I may share in his sufferings, being made conformable unto his death. That something about pain was essential for the growth process, to become the person one was meant to be. I think through my process of hurting, that I've become much more sensitive to people. I'd never been sick before a day in my life, except colds and such, and was amazingly well. And all of a sudden, I was face to face with death. And now, you know, with the burden of pain day by day. But I can see remarkable things it's done as far as sensitizing me to listen to people, becoming alive to a whole division of life that I never knew before. I knew it, you know, theoretically, but never experimentally. And I don't think you can really share with someone unless you've gone through that process yourself. I took an alcoholic in last week to an alcoholic center, a hospital. And I can recall the last one I brought. The fellow who was the interviewer sat in his chair on his in yoga fashion, and when I brought this fellow in, he said, 2:30, said this counselor. And the man said, what do you mean? You come in at 2:30. Well, he said, I just came in to check this place out. 2:30. And so the man said, I can't, I got fixed right on a big important person. He's got two corporations. He said, it's physically impossible for me to come at 2:30. And the little guy says, 2:30. 30 minutes, this man floundered, he fished, he ran like a fish caught on the end of a hook. He fought it every inch of the way. And the man never got off this little phrase, 2:30, 2:30, 2:30. After 30, 40 minutes of it, I said, Joe, I'll bring you in at 2:30. He said, okay. And then the interviewer totally opened up. He was happy, kind, talked about his own difficulties. He'd been an alcoholic, was one. Family broken and all the rest. Then he opened up his own personality and discovered he was just like the man I brought in. Well, I would never use a ticket for that. You know, 2:32, like no broken record. But he knew the alcoholic. He read him like a book. I think when we experience pain, we become part and parcel of the world's pain and comprehend, as we sang in the hymn tonight, that God suffers in all our pain now. He's not extraneous, something away from it.
that pain is the process of his growth, if we're part of one kind of theology, or at least we fulfill the sufferings of the body of Christ, when it isn't something we particularly invite. I feel you wanted to say something.
No.
Uh-huh.
Mr. Wu?
Yes.
We are so aware of God's presence here at Holden.
Yes.
Would you share with us the message that you shared in your book when you first realized that you were paralyzed, of God's presence?
But I go back just a bit before that, because there's no question about the reality of God and suffering in every single bit of our lives and living, where Jesus says he notices even the hoppings of the sparrow. The King James is the sparrow that falls, but I think the Greek says when it flips and flops and makes its little jumps. Marge had a very strong perception, intuition, vision, whatever she wants to call it, of me having of a severe injury about 5 months before it happened, when she knew I'd never been sick, remarkably healthy, when she was called to a national office in women's work of our church, when we prayed about it, fought over it for 5-6 weeks inside our own spirits. When I came home on a Saturday night, I said, I don't think you should take it. And she agreed. The next night I came home, we both felt she ought to take it. And so she did. That meant she'd live in Minneapolis, I'd live in Garden Grove, California. Well, a month later, I guess about 3 months before you were to be inducted into office, one Sunday afternoon she said, this is insane. It's nuts that I go there and he stay here. And when she was about to rescind her acceptance of her position, she had a clear vision of the fact that I'd be severely injured. She never told me. She wept, called a couple of her friends, one long distance. And when I was the opening speaker in Cincinnati for the national convention, she was installed. And just a month later, I broke my neck. But the amazing thing, amongst many others, was that I was hospitalized 9 weeks. And I hurt beyond description. I thought I was in a cross frame like Jesus. I felt it was barbed wire around my head. The pain was so awesome, I was in orbit. Yet Marge and the medical staff affirmed that every single moment I was in ecstasy. I was radiant with joy. And that wasn't something I created or I concocted. It was the prayers of the people of God, all of the verses and the truths about Jesus that surfaced, and the fact that I recognized his presence. He was so visible, so real. Things that happened in the hospital, healings that happened, miracles that happened. And I recognized the presence of Christ who promised, I'll never leave you nor forsake you. And the resurrection became a reality in the hospital for me. Because 6 weeks after my injury, when my neurosurgeon, who had done 14 years of postgraduate study, when he came and met Marge in the hall, she asked him, is my husband doing well? And he said, what do you mean, Mrs. Wold? Is he doing as well as he ought? And he said, my dear Mrs. Wold, your husband shouldn't be. I used to watch him when I could hardly breathe those first weeks coming to see me. 1 and 1:30 at night, clicking his teeth. And I thought, is this idiot my surgeon? He was clicking his teeth because he couldn't believe I was breathing. So I recognized the presence, and where the presence of Christ is, there is life.
In response to Brad's kind of question, and I think my experience in 20 years in the parish, plus a few in the campus, and probably John can speak to this too, that not every encounter with pain and agony comes out like this. And not every response to pain and agony is like that. And Erling's is a very legitimate, faith-filled response. And in opposition to that is the moan and the cry, the despondent agony I don't know, that's almost hopeless. To decree that that is a faithless cry of agony, I'm not sure is a legitimate kind of a judgment. You know, that we, it may be, it has something to do with thresholds of pain or something, but, you know, just to refer to the psalmist says, God damn it, I've had enough. You know, I can't take anymore. He doesn't say it exactly that way, but pretty near.
I think he would say it that way.
Yeah.
Because I would like to respond that my response to pain is more like that. Erling is more accepting, and I rebel. I mean, I fight it every inch of the way. I know that, I know the presence of the Lord. I know that I was given a form, you know, a picture in advance, a visualization that Erling would be, and I trusted that, but I still fight it every day. And I fight the fact that Erling has to live with pain. I will minister to him in his pain, and I will, you know, praise the Lord while I'm fighting it. But my reaction was to go down to the ocean and kick at the waves and scream, damn you, I hate you. You know, you zapped my husband and
she says, I'm even her ocean reject.
So I think that that's still a faithful reaction to pain, but it's different. And I would not like to leave the impression that in order to be a Christian and react to pain, you have to, you know, as you say, maybe fit the Christian faithful reaction.
Right. Too often when in visiting hospitals, and this may be a clergy problem, the thing is have faith and it'll go away or something like that. That's not true. Or to make judgments like your pain is because you're not believing enough or something. It's all
Rick has his hand.
Bad stuff. I'm sorry. Rick, way in the back. Yeah, let's get to the people.
Maybe a third reaction, and I don't know how to say it precisely, but I respond by to pain by trying to avoid it wherever I see it. It's not that I fight against it or that I accept it. I guess I really don't mind the pain so much in myself as I do in others, and I almost feel an allergic reaction. I can't deal with other people's hurt. And in fact, I guess maybe it's the world that's so constituted that I don't have to. But I really worry that someday it's all going to come down on me like it did, you know, to you, and I'm going to have to deal with it because I have to live with it. I mean, it'll be with the loved ones that I can't avoid. But as soon as somebody gets pain, we put them away, like when they get old, or, you know, and so we don't take care of or run into pain too often. And I don't want to see it. I don't want to know about it. It scares me to go into, I get sick in the parking lot of a hospital. And doggone, my wife works in there. And I cannot identify with how she deals with pain every day of her life. I don't want her to talk to me about her work. And I don't know whether, you know, I really think that that's a strong flaw in my character. There's something very un-Christian about
it. No, I think probably
it's not funny.
I'm not sure that's the judgment to make. I think there's something very human about that.
That doesn't mean it isn't
un-Christian. That if you're going to blame anybody, blame God. I mean, he's the idiot that put you together, you know.
Thanks, John.
Okay, John, you want to respond to that? Oh, gentleman over here.
I'd like to ask the doctor if he knows what he has to say about this Canadian clinic, which teaches people to and when we are possibly to submerge pain, is this related to the progress in birth that you mentioned, and how about this?
Yes, this is the whole process. That, we're trying to help people to sublimate pain. In other words, to cover over it with other emotions and with awareness of other functions of your body. In the woman, for instance, who's giving birth, we try to control her breathing, make her concentrate on taking long, slow, deep breaths or in panting. We encourage her husband to rub her back or massage her back or scratch her back. This is to bring other sensory stimuli in so that you're, in a sense, you're overwhelming the brain with multiple senses and not fastening on the pain senses only. And this will help people to deal with them more. I wanted to say one other thing. I think that our society in Madison Avenue has sold us the story that we don't have to deal with pain anymore, that there is always a cure or some antidote for pain. And I think as we said this morning in the session, we talked about a change in people's health awareness and the fact that they are becoming more and more aware that they are in charge of their health, and what they do with their body has a lot to do with what their health in life will be. And I think another facet of that also is that their life is not going to be completely pain-free, and that they need to learn to deal with pain and not always look for the pill or the way of avoiding it. And I think that's one of the more healthy aspects of our society nowadays.
As a physician, just a quickie, you know, is there value in pain? What does it do? It's an indicator of something. You just, now everybody's going to go out and live with their pain and never see a doctor, right?
Okay.
Their gallbladder will explode.
I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. I don't want you to avoid all pain. But I have lots of people who come to me for every little pain, no matter how small it may be. And things which would, you would probably laugh about the fact that they would go to the trouble of scheduling an appointment with a physician. Many times the pain has gone away before they ever got to me, but they still want to tell me about the pain that I had in this joint some 2 weeks ago, which lasted several hours. And I'm not kidding you, people do come in and take my time to tell me about a pain, and they want an explanation of what that pain was and how they could deal with it if it ever came back again. And so I think we as a people and in our education process somewhere need to talk to people and educate people about levels of pain, what type of pain is likely to be more associated with a more serious disease process going on within the body, and what aches and pains are pretty much the natural sequelae of living a normal life and being active and doing things.
A question was coming
here. Now this is not to make the men feel like I'm a favor of women's livers necessarily, but nevertheless, it seems to me that sometimes it's overlooked. The ladies who spoke. Sometimes I think that those who watch and wait go through an agony that they don't get credit for having. And that is a pain that you're supposed to be brave and you're not supposed to bawl and all such things, and that can leave scars on a person, I think. And I have seen that happen in my life. I've seen someone who suffers, and not trying to downgrade your suffering. I have had my share, but I have appreciated that love and patience with me and understanding and standing by and getting no credit from it, from society per se, you see. I was the guy who was in pain and oh, ain't he in a mess. But I just had to throw that in, that is a type of pain that doesn't get the credit, if that's the word to use, no. That it deserves. And I just want to say that I thank you, God, for the love of people who care in that matter.
John, respond.
I want to add to that that this is one thing I think that's really healthy about the new obstetrics, because the father is in the delivery room experiencing the pain with the mother of the birth of that child. And I think that that really does a lot for their closeness together, a man and a wife giving birth to this child. It used to be the father was back in the smoke-filled room pacing up and down and never experienced any of that pain. His was kind of an agony of waiting to find out what it was all about. But now he's in the delivery room experiencing that pain, and I think that's a very healthy thing.
He's wondering where's the boy or girl, see?
Nice.
Well, that makes me sound very noble. I'm not a very noble person.
No, I don't think so.
In fact, I'm pretty tough. And I think maybe I'm sometimes too tough on Erling. I don't give him an awful lot of sympathy. And I think I learned that from his therapist. He had a therapist who, with all the odds against him, because Erling by right should be quadriplegic, to a certain extent he minimally is, but he should not have been functional in the way he is. And his neurosurgeon said, less than a 2% chance of ever walking again. And or of ever working again. And Joe Chasen, the therapist, was bound and determined that if there was even any 2% possibility, Erling was going to walk. And so he started in, and he demanded of Erling 110% of energy and effort and work. And I watched him, you know, just feel Erling's muscles, and where he sensed the slightest response, he worked on it immediately. If there was a slight response in the arms, okay, the arms, Erling had used them. And I watched him make Erling sit up one day, and it took Erling 20 minutes. He showed him how to use his legs as a lever and sit up, 20 minutes of sweating and agony. And finally, Erling got his body just a little bit off the bed, and Joe helped him just enough to get him up, immediately fell to the side. Joe hit him on his arm. He fell over to the other side, he whapped him on the arm, he said, sit up, and he hit him again. And he kept doing that till Erling sat alone for like 1 second before he fell back again. And I watched Joe just almost beat Erling into, but Erling's response was work. And so I was going to say to Rich, but he's gone, that unless you're willing to walk into your pain and just work with it, he probably wouldn't have recovered. But I learned from Joe that sometimes the best kind of love has to be pretty tough.
That's
so
right.
When Erling came home from the hospital, and he was then walking a little bit, but he had never used his hands. He'd been fed for 10 weeks in the hospital, and I had to shave him and all that sort of stuff. But, and he came home with his arms bound around him, and I, that first night he came home, I sat him down at the table and I said, you have been fed your last meal. If you're going to eat for the rest of your life, you're going to have to start learning right now. And of course our daughter said, oh, you're just mean, I'll feed you, Daddy. And I said, oh no, you won't. And I think one of the worst things that can happen to Erling is when people let him manipulate them into getting stuff for him and doing stuff for him. And he knows he can do that. And I know that he can do that. But you have to run the risk, I think. And that's where I see the whole pain and suffering thing coming, is in that God's love is sometimes very tough.
Right.
And so I see Erling as being a much better person than he was before. I see our relationship. I'd never seen him cry in 30 years of marriage until he had his accident. Never shed a tear. His father died. He buried his best friends and all that. Never shed a tear. When our kids were sick, when I was in the hospital. And finally, with the accident, he learned to cry. Mm-hmm. And now he can weep with those who weep, as well as rejoice with those who rejoice. And I see him as, really God's person in a much deeper way. And I think without that toughness of God's love. Now, I'm not saying everybody has to suffer, but in Erling's case, apparently that's what was needed. And in my case, also.
Well, all you've done is reinforce what I've said, that within the heart of you, you have suffered.
Oh, yeah,
you
no
suffer
doubt
pain.
About it.
And that's the thing, and to be tough, as you call it, because I had to go through the same thing, my folks to me. I was not allowed, I was crippled when I was a little boy. And I was, my brothers were not allowed to fetch and carry. I was given no sympathy or anything of that kind. I haven't gone through anything that he has. But I know what had happened. My mother has told me of the pain in her heart. And yet I thought nothing of it, you see. I learned to grow up that not knowing I was supposed to be crippled. But I still say that the heart of people, the ones who have to watch and wait, so to speak, there is an inner agony. I don't care how you disguise it or how tough you get on the outside to do the job that has to be done. I still say that those who have to watch and wait, there is a suffering and an agony within themselves that people or society in general doesn't quite recognize. Sometimes people don't even know it of themselves, I think. And I just wanted to pay tribute to those kind of people and their kind of pain.
I'd like to respond to what both of you are saying. The Chinese, in Chinese medicine, two attitudes toward pain are recognized. And one is sympathy and one is compassion. And in sympathy, if you sympathize with a person in pain, you try to put yourself into his shoes, and I think this is what I hear Rich getting all scared about. You are sucked into his point of view. You see it from his perspective. You get in there and you wallow in his pain with him. And sympathy does the one in pain no good at all. Compassion, on the other hand, deals with pain by responding to it and acknowledging it, yes, but from your own viewpoint of health and wholeness. And then going about doing what has to be done to get the person in pain back into a state of health and wholeness. And I think, you know, what we're hearing said tonight that's working, that's really dealing with pain, you know, head on, are the situations where we have people dealing with people, where
compassion.
With compassion. And I haven't even heard him mention painkillers. You know, I don't know what choices you had along the road as far as letting technology come in and take over your pain for you.
Some aspirin. So.
And were those your choices? Could they have done more?
They suggested it.
And you decided you would rather carry the burden on your own rather than...
Well, we work with it. You know, we do some relaxing things. I suppose some self-hypnosis, relaxing and breathing, and laying on of hands.
Yeah.
And praying. Before we came over tonight, Erling was, his legs were having spasms, so he lay down on the bed and we prayed until his body was relaxed. So we work with it. And I suppose those.
I think one of the best therapeutic techniques is always to begin the morning with praise. The one that I lived with is the 34th Psalm. I think that's one of the most beautiful in the Living Bible in the Old Testament. We enshrined it in our first book. But I will praise the Lord no matter what happens. I will constantly speak of his glories and grace. I will boast of all of his kindnesses to me. Let all who are discouraged take heart. Let us praise the Lord together and exalt his name. For I cried to him and he answered me. He freed me from all my fears. Others too were radiant at what he did for them. Theirs was no downcast look of rejection. This poor man cried to the Lord, and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all of his troubles. Oh, put God to the test and see how kind he is. So first thing in the morning, thank and praise him. It's like a friend of mine in Texas said, he was healed, you know, fantastically from leukemia, and said that he has helped 5,000 leukemia patients in the last 6 years. He said the leukemia disease or the virus is a weaker cell than the healthy cells. So he thinks health, he thinks wholeness, and the healthy cells, he says, it happened in him, helps him overcome the weak cells, the destructive ones. There's no question, I think, about this wholeness of our bodies, and that thought has a lot to do with wholeness.
I will assume it as my prerogative to declare an end to this, and that's going to be 9 o'clock. If there are any of you who want to, 10 o'clock. 10. About 12 or 13 more minutes, and I'm sure you can stay around and ask more personal questions if you care.
Till 6:45.
Another here, Esther.
Yeah, at the time that I had to go through a very serious spinal thing, I was having a reaction. Was I wanted to die. I just wanted to die. I kept saying that. Pastor Eugene came up and he had me read with Peter. After he suffered a while, I will strengthen you, make you whole, and recruit you. Yeah. I threw the Bible at him. Oh boy, I was so mad and not going to hit him. But he said what was beautiful about it was he had the whole church pulling together for one thing to get me well, and that made me madder because I didn't want to get well. I didn't want to hurt him. And that was my reaction, was just, no way, just keep it on. But there were so many prayers that got past that first part, and I could get to walk again. But that was another facet of why somebody hurts sometimes, is to pull a group of Christians together who have been kind of going their own way. It's how he felt at that time.
I'm not sure that's why you hurt.
No, maybe not why, but it worked.
I really like to take it kind of an exception to that. That's one of the byproducts of hurting, you know, that a community gets involved in. The sympathy, the cries with somebody, the rejoicing at the birth and the sorrow at a death. That's church. You know, that's people together, and those things are included in our prayers, and we yawn. No, but I don't think we should. That's the church in action. Oh, there were a couple of other hands. Yes.
One of the interesting things that happens when you look at pain that you or other people are having and you search for ways outside medication to handle them is sort of an enriching of a person's self-image and self-worth. You see a lot of people who in our PT department who have a certain amount of pain, a certain amount of spasm, have a lifestyle that demands a schedule which is disrupted by this, they're upset by it, they want relief, and they'll probably get it no more likely by physical means than by medication at that point. And then you can get together sometimes and talk people into taking time to treat their body well, to put back into their own hands rather than somebody else's hands some of the mechanisms of pain relief. And again, you're back into the childbirth example. But to take the time, to take the 15 minutes at the end of the day or the beginning of the day or in between to go through some relaxation techniques, to learn the practice of some pain-relieving exercises. People more often will say, I don't have the time, I don't have the privacy, and you say you are important enough. That is a missing thing sometimes, that people feel that their own right to self-care, that you can demand out of a busy schedule of family demands, of work demands, that you can take time out just to let your body heal or feel better. It almost seems like you're not worth it or you don't have that. And that's a very, very helpful thing.
Can I mention?
Yes.
Now, I was up in Alaska. I spoke various places around the world for the Air Force. And there's one trip to Alaska. Marge and I and another man were supposed to be on a team of three, and finally I was the only one there. I had talks on the hour from 8 to 10 all day long. I got up at 4 in the morning, exhausted. It was snowing out, 40 below zero, 70 wind chill. I suddenly began to laugh. I wasn't looking for the white coats, but I saw the snowflakes, and it suddenly struck me. Snowflakes are the laughter of God. Because we just discovered that some of the ice floes melting formed at the time of Christ, maybe a mile deep, everyone unique, everyone a perfect hexagon. And suddenly struck me, Napoleon and Hitler were stopped by snowflakes. You know? And then I read an article in a magazine called Saturday Review by Norman Cousins 14 years ago, crippling arthritis, given up for death. He was healed by his specialist telling him laughter, so he bought some old stupid comics, movies, intravenous injections of vitamin C, and a will to live. And he recovered, waited 12 years, published it in New England Journal of Medicine. He published it later in his own publication. Some lawyer called him and said, my daughter has encephalitis. Shall I give her vitamin C? He said, sure, ask my doc. Doc said, yes. He asked his. He said, BS, only he spelled it out. So the lawyer, being sharp, waited a day till anger cooled. Then he said, can I give my daughter ice cream? Why, sure. He said, she's dying. It won't hurt her any. He loaded with the vitamin C, and she got healed. So he got 6,000 letters from 60 countries from doctors commending him. The thing that amazed me was that last fall he was put on the UCLA medical staff, faculty, sold his paper, as a professor of medicine. He never took a course in it, but he spent 35 years studying it. That's been his avocation. So it's interesting that laughter is very important. And then it struck me, finally, you know, my Scandinavian brain works slowly, that the book of Hebrews says laughter is really the other side of faith. It means that you know it's going to happen. God's in this thing. It's interesting. But laughter is the plus side of faith. It says everything works together for good, those who love God. And that's true. Sarah Abraham, yeah, she, when she was 90, he was 100. Past menopause, she had a baby. She called him Laughter.
John wants to get in on this.
Does everybody know what the term placebo means?
Yeah.
Okay. For those of you who don't, a placebo is a...
one of the finest financial returns to the doctor. That's a nasty one.
A placebo is a pill or a gelatin capsule that is filled with a substance that could not possibly have any effects on the body. What we frequently use is milk sugar. And all of medicines are measured against placebo in terms of their effectiveness. We measure pain relief against aspirin, because aspirin is what we call the base level, I kind of like a zero level. Mm-hmm. And we measure everything on how does it relieve pain in relation to aspirin. And you'd be surprised how many people are cured by placebo. Mm-hmm. And when we run a study, we take hundreds of people, we call what we call double blind studies, and The doctors don't know whether they're giving placebo or giving real medicine. And these people are diagnosed, and we try to match people according to age and you know, lifestyle and all of these kind of things, so that we have an accurate measurement of two different substances, placebo against whatever pill we're trying to take. And the placebo always cures a certain segment. Maybe 30 to 70% of people who have, for instance, pain will be cured by placebo. And if say the level was 30 to 70, or say 30% were cured by placebo, and the new substance that we were trying to test cured only 35%, then we could say that it doesn't have very much efficacy in relation to the placebo. And I use placebos all the time in my work to find out if people really have pain. One of my best placebos in the hospital is an injection of sterile saline. It's a white substance that really burns quite a bit after it's injected, and the person really thinks they've gotten a powerful drug. And if they get a total relief of their pain, then I have to question, where is that pain coming from? Is it more of a functional pain, or is it a physical pain? And I also use this in oral medications. People who want more and more pain relief, and I will give them a milk sugar capsule to see how much relief they get from that.
You're saying vitamin C in that case, probably.
Yeah, vitamin C was the thing that brought that to my mind, because I feel that vitamin C is the large placebo of our society nowadays that's being fueled by a physicist down in California.
Yes, there's another side to the coin. All pain is not psychosomatic related.
Not.
And there are places where pain preparations are very important.
Oh, right.
And,
but that's the whole purpose of the placebo, is to try and decipher that, because you can't tell sometimes.
Well, not only in pain, but in all scientific studies today, mm-hmm. placebo is used.
Mm-hmm. Back here, in the observation.
Isn't it possible that the placebo is acting on the mind, so that you're not really giving credit to the other pill that might have been doing some good? I'm taking the devil's advocate here.
No, it would have to show a significant improvement. For instance, if it was only, let's say the placebo was 30% and the new pill that we were trying to test was only 35%, there's not enough difference between placebo and new pill to say that that's a significant step up. So you would be looking for a pill that, for instance, gave 70 to 80 to 90% relief as opposed to 30% for the placebo. Then we could say there was a significant difference between those two, and the one must be active in working towards solving that problem or curing that disease process. The mind is in control of pain.
Yeah, I see, but it would be in control in all cases.
But you see, this helps the doctor to determine which way do I need to go now in order to help this person deal with their pain. If the placebo has no effect on the pain, then obviously we have to go the chemical route or the surgical route or some other route to try to relieve that pain. If the placebo has a major effect on that pain, then maybe we need to turn more to talking about psychiatric or dealing with the social aspect of that patient for helping them with their problem.
The trouble with listening to a doctor is, now the next time you get a shot and it stings, you're going to wonder. Yeah.
You're being stuck.
I think we should end. And thank the people, the participants, for their fine comments. I think we